Welcome to Intellectual Property Matters. In this WIPO podcast, we explore the fascinating world of creativity, innovation, and intellectual property. Let's listen, learn, and get inspired.
Hello, I'm Ben Ryland. Welcome to the second episode of Eye on Copyright Enforcement. Today, we'll hear from the Motion Picture Association about the ongoing copyright infringement case against Mega Upload, a popular file hosting platform that provided access to millions of gigabytes of copyright-protected content, most of it pirated. The early days of the internet looked quite different to what we're used to today. For many of us, social media sites like Instagram and TikTok are the main points of reference for sharing information, whether it's a funny video, holiday pictures, or daily musings on the tiniest details of everyday life. But there was a time when the idea of sharing information online often meant something quite different. The arrival of file-sharing sites helped give rise to a whole new industry of media piracy, mainly the illegal sharing of films, television, and music. One of those sites, called Mega Upload, was launched in 2005, and it was the brainchild of a rather colourful character named Kim.com. My guest today is Karen Temple, Global General Counsel for the Motion Picture Association. Karen, welcome to the show. To start, can you take us back to the early 2000s? What was Mega Upload back then?
Well, Mega Upload was actually, at one point in time, the 13th most visited site on the entire internet with 4% of the worldwide internet traffic. I mean, it was a website that had 50 million daily visitors, but it wasn't simply selling candy canes. It was an unlawful, what we call cyber locker, that made stolen films and movies available worldwide via what they called an incentive system. And so users were rewarded for uploading illegal popular content to the site, which was often stolen films, TV shows, and sometimes video games, music, and their pay was based on how many times the content was then downloaded by someone else. So the more you put up stolen films, the more pay or that you got as a user for that. And Mega Upload was then paid through advertisements to the website, as well as they had premium, what they called premium subscriptions, where some people actually paid to get kind of greater and faster access through the site. You know, cyber lockers can be legitimate sites. So it can be just a, you know, if you're not putting stolen films and movies and music on it, it can just be a storage, a cloud storage. And what was unique about this, though, it was taking something that could be used to store any type of legitimate content. So your term papers, your photographs, but turning it into an illegal structure that allowed for people to, from around the world, to then sign in and store these illegal films, music, video games. So it was kind of unique by taking something that was legitimate and then turning it into something that was unlawful.
Now, of course, there was an indictment brought against Kim.com. What was he accused of doing?
Yes. Yeah, so in January of 2012, Kim.com, who was the founder of Mega Upload, and some of his associates were indicted by a grand jury actually in Virginia in the United States. And the site operators were charged with basically engaging in a massive criminal copyright infringement, as well as racketeering. So it was a conspiracy, racketeering, and copyright infringement case against a Mega Upload that kind of started the public's more general, you know, interest in the goings-ons of the Mega Upload.
And what was in it for him? Can you explain a little bit about how lucrative these activities might have been?
Yeah, that's what was kind of really striking about this particular case. So in the indictment, it noted that the defendants had criminal proceeds more than $175 million. And Kim.com himself was certainly not shy about showing the proceeds of his criminal activity. So this was a guy who had actually a pretty large Twitter following, and he would boast about the kind of types of illegal gotten goods he was able to get from the proceeds of his criminal activity. He had 3 silver Mercedes with license plates that were labeled good and evil. I don't know if he parked them all in a row so you could see them, but that was some of his cars. And then he had a number of other cars with license plates such as Mafia, Hacker, Stoned, and just to put it in, I think, our face, the word guilty was one of his license plates. He had a 25,000 square foot mansion. I believe it was in New Zealand. And so this was, not something that he was doing for free or somehow just doing to, for the public benefit. I mean, this was a huge criminal conspiracy in which he and the other defendants were able to make massive amounts of money off the backs of the content that other people should have been rightly paid for, just like any other criminal conspiracy.
Well, he certainly wasn't a shy character and still isn't even today. Now, of course, as you mentioned, that indictment did eventually come. How did Kim.com and his associates respond?
Well, they did respond fairly aggressively. They challenged the indictment. I think there were search warrants and things that were done in New Zealand, which they challenged as well. The actual process there. So they aggressively challenged both the indictment and all of the procedures that were surrounding it. And one of the things that amazingly we're still waiting on is that they challenged the extradition back to the United States. So there are, a number of defendants who are not located in the United States, even though the indictment is in the United States. And so we still do not have Kim.com extradited to be able to face a jury here in the US. He is still currently fighting that. And more recently, actually, several defendants of his co-defendants actually pled guilty in New Zealand to avoid being extradited to the US. So it's even though the indictment was first in 2012, there have been a lot of different legal proceedings that are still ongoing, and we still haven't gotten to kind of that final stage of the case where we actually can have that criminal trial against Kim.com and some of the defendants.
Karen, why is it so hard to enforce copyright infringement internationally?
Well, it's complicated by the individual laws of each country. And that is one of the things that makes copyright enforcement today somewhat more difficult than we've ever had it before, because, you're talking often about cases that involve a lot of different jurisdictions. You might have individuals who are defendants in one location, their servers where they're storing the legal files, computer files in another location, co-defendants in another. And so a lot of different jurisdictions and countries are involved. And you have to go through a often very onerous legal proceeding, either if you're trying to sue them civilly or even if you're doing it criminally. And in the Kim.com case, he challenged the extradition basically at every single level within the New Zealand court system. So I think he challenged it kind of like what we would call the district court level, and then he appealed it. So every time the U.S. was attempting to extradite, he would challenge that extradition, and then you would have to go through a proceeding, and then you would then have to, then he would appeal that proceeding. And so that's why it's taking so long, because often some of these, legal proceedings can take years to actually become final.
As we mentioned, Karen, you represent the Motion Picture Association, which became involved in the case early on. Why did that happen, and how did the MPA's involvement impact things?
It was the film studio's content that was a large part of what the stolen, materials that were being used and sold on the website. So as I said, there were films, there was music, there was video games, but films were a large part of that. We often will participate in criminal investigations if they, you know, against, you know, various copyright infringement that is done on a commercial scale. We will, for example, help with evidence. We will provide information about the films and shows that are being stolen, showing that they're being stolen, that they're not being authorized to be on that website. And so that's what we did in this particular case, preparing evidence that the law enforcement could use for their criminal indictment. Then we also did something separately, which we often do in these cases, and that is we actually sued civilly as well. So we, along with the record companies, brought civil litigation against Kim.com and Mega Upload for the illegal conduct as well.
Still to come on the program, we'll hear from Karen on how the long-term impact of the Mega Upload case changed the international enforcement of copyright infringement. Stay tuned. You are listening to Eye on Copyright Enforcement. Still with me is Karen Temple. She's the Global General Counsel for the Motion Picture Association. We're talking about how the actions of Kim.com and his Mega Upload file sharing site impacted the enforcement of copyright infringement globally. Karen, there were obviously many legal implications following this case, but what about the impact on the public perception of copyright enforcement? I mean, do you think it changed the way that we think about what copyright actually means?
Well, you know, I do, because, you know, in some sense, the sensationalism of this particular case, I think, was hopefully able to show the public that these type of copyright infringement cases are just like other criminal cases, just like other cases of theft and, you know, racketeering and criminal conspiracies. A lot of times in the past, you've had people who've argued that somehow copyright infringement itself is a victimless crime, or it doesn't hurt anybody, or the people who are doing it just because they want to get content out there. But I think the way this case proceeded, the way that Kim.com and the defendants boasted about all of the various money that they were able to get through this illegal website, very, very publicly, again, showed, hopefully, to the average person that they're doing it for greed, just like any other criminal. And so I think the fact that people were able to see that this is a defendant who, again, and the co-defendants who were able to make more than $175 million, who are able to have cars and jet skis and you know, mansions. You see the victims because you are actually able to see how much money is being made, and that this money is, again, not going to the creators. It's instead going into the pocket of Kim.com so he can, you know, have a license plate that says guilty on it.
What challenges do content creators and distribution platforms, I think, in film and music industries face today when it comes to enforcing copyright?
Yeah, I think that it's getting more difficult just because of the complexity, again, of the multiple different jurisdictions that you have to deal with. As I said before, you're going to have cases that have aspects of each case in various different countries. So often now we have to deal with law enforcement in multiple different countries, even if we're going after one website. Then, of course, you're dealing not only with law enforcement in multiple different countries, you're dealing with the laws in multiple different countries. And sometimes those laws, they're usually not conflicting, but they might be different in terms of the strength of their legal protections for copyright, for example. So you have to research and understand the various laws of each country that you might have to go into, just again, to go after one specific target. And so that makes it really complicated, understanding how the overall global legal system is working and how you can go after the target, wherever that target may be. So that is one of the, I think, the most difficult aspects of enforcing now, just the global nature of online piracy.
And what about some of the smaller content creators? How does online copyright infringement affect some of those artists who may not have some of the resources that those big entertainment conglomerates have?
Right. I mean, so as I said, imagine, you know, a individual trying to go after targets in multiple jurisdictions, or having to send what, you know, like many, many content, large content owners do, millions of DMCA notices weekly or monthly. That's just something that is out of reach for most independent and small creators. And so, it is really unfortunate, because we often talk about the fact that, you know, if you don't have redress, you don't really have a right. So, you know, a right without some way to enforce the right is no right at all. And, you know, so you have creators who have this copyright in their works, but if they can't enforce it because they can't stop someone from selling it, that it's meaningless to them. And so that's actually been something that has been discussed a lot in a lot of different countries. And in the United States, I actually am, you know, glad to say that they have done something recently about that by passing in the last couple of years what we call the CASE Act, which was a provision that it created basically a small claims court for essentially smaller creators, independent creators, to be able to get into court without having the enormous amount of resources that are needed and costs that are needed if you're going into regular federal court. So it's a small kind of claims court in the United States Copyright Office, so that there is this form of redress for smaller creators. But that is how difficult it is often for creators to be able to protect their rights. And we had to actually, in the United States, create an entirely new tribunal to be able to help assist independent and small creators to protect their rights.
So Karen, if you're talking to someone who is an independent artist, perhaps, what would your top tips for them be if they think that some of their intellectual property is at risk or has been infringed upon?
Yeah, I would say, especially those in the United States, to go to the United States Copyright Office. As a former director of the U.S. Copyright Office, I think it is a really great resource for all content owners, but small creators and independent creators as well. There's a lot of information. One of the most important things in the U.S. is to register your copyrights. It's not required to be, to protect your copyrights, to have a copyright to register in the U.S., but you do need to have a registered copyright to be able to go into court. And so that's why it's very important for you as an artist to be able to register copyright. It also affects your ability to get what we call in the United States statutory damages, which are usually much higher than your actual damages. So it's important to register your copyrights, both to be able to get into court, but also to get access to statutory damages in the United States. So that's, I think, one of the biggest tips that I would give. And then to utilize all types of different organizations that might be out there that can help. There are, organizations like the Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts, other organizations that on a pro bono basis might be able to assist those independent and small creators as well in terms of protecting their rights.
And just finally, Karen, I understand that the MPA has a sister organization called ACE. Can you tell me a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, so ACE is stands for the Alliance for Creativity and Entertainment. And we like to call it the world's leading content protection coalition worldwide, dedicated to combating copyright infringement around the world. And one of the things that is unique about ACE is that it's not made up just of the MPA studios. It is actually made up of the MPA studios plus a number of different content owners globally. So we include the MPA, the six MPA studios. Apple TV is a member, Amazon is a member, Canal Plus is a member, and we also have organizations, again, from around the world. So we have organizations that are based, local content owners that are based in Asia, that are based in the European Union, that are based all around the world with one goal in mind, and that is to protect content and to ensure that we can combat digital piracy. And so we have a team of nearly 100 investigators that are basically working around the clock to find targets out there that are stealing our members' content, our members who are our ACE members' content, go after them wherever they may be. So sometimes that might be us knocking on the door and in the Middle East. Sometimes it might be knocking on the door in Asia to literally go after these content owners wherever they might be located. Sometimes it's through civil suits. Sometimes it's working with criminal law enforcement. And we have been, you know, really pleased with our progress on this in terms of the ability to attack this global problem at the scale that we are currently able to with the amount of resources we've been putting in by having so many different partners participate. So it's a growing coalition every day. We seem to have a new coalition. I think we just hit over 50 members of ACE worldwide, and we're continuing to expand that to make sure that, again, we can stamp out online piracy wherever it may be in the world.
Karen Temple, thank you very much for joining us. Karen, of course, is the Global General Counsel for the Motion Picture Association. And thank you for listening to Eye on Copyright Enforcement, a production of the World Intellectual Property Organization, brought to you with the support of the Ministry of Culture, Sports and Tourism of the Republic of Korea. I'm Ben Ryland. I'll be back next time with another conversation on copyright enforcement. I do hope you'll join me. Until then, goodbye.